Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Ledman. We want to talk about the economy today with Rick Wolf. Rick is professor emeritus at the University of Massachusetts. He's now, I hope I'm keeping up with him, he is a fast mover. he is, I believe, Rick, you are now New School University Graduate Program and International Affairs Visiting Professor. I'm sure you've got other credentials beside that, and I've mentioned that you've written numerous books and articles. You've done so for over 40 years. We're in the same generation, more or less, and your topics range from modern imperialism, the economics of colonialism, current economic crisis conditions, and a whole lot more. Before we get into it, Rick, I do want to say something because this is my first chance to make a comment on my own program about Hugo Chavez. I've written four articles. Three of them are out. I wrote one this morning. It's drafted. I'll polish it up a little bit. I'll get it out tomorrow. Oh, excuse me. I had, if I'm keeping my count right, I think I had four interviews on Chavez. And the article I put out yesterday, I called Chavez a personal tribute. Let me just say a few things that I wrote in it. I compared Venezuela under Chavez with America under you name whoever. It doesn't matter. Bush, Obama, the man in the moon, Mickey Mouse, it's all the same thing. It's the same ugly wealth, power, and dominant system. Rule of law principles don't matter. Democratic values are trashed. Popular needs are ignored. Chavez, for 14 years in Venezuela, was polar opposite. He championed, this is what I wrote, Chavez was polar opposite. He championed democracy. He established the real thing. He defended civil and human rights. He operated no secret prisons. He didn't invade his neighbors. He engaged them cooperatively. He valued unity and world solidarity. He abhorred torture. He advocated peace, not war. He abolished neoliberal harshness. He championed populism. Venezuelans loved him for doing so. They elected him overwhelmingly four times. They rallied support for him publicly. They did so often. At times, millions turned out, literally millions turned out supporting him. He established free, open, and fair elections. Jimmy Carter calls them the world's best. He did so for good reason. They shame America's sham process. It has no legitimacy whatsoever. He valued Venezuela's independence. He fought hard to keep it that way. He refused to surrender to Washington. He used Venezuela's oil wealth responsibly. He lifted millions from poverty. He created economic growth and jobs. He provided essential social services. Major ones are institutionalized. He's loved and admired worldwide. He's hated for his virtues. He made promises, and guess what? He kept them. He cared about ordinary people. He showed it. His legacy won't be forgotten. I could go on and on. I have a lot more in the article talking about Chavismo. It lives in Bolivarianism. It's real. And don't expect it to go away, even without Chavez. Rick, if you want to jump in with a comment, I welcome it.
Sure. For me, what is most remarkable about Chavez is not, I am not going to get into the debate about strengths and weaknesses of his government or his style of government. In the United States, we tend to have a very unfortunate and primitive political way of evaluating people. We seem to think that in order to support and praise a political leader, he has to have the qualities of a god. And likewise, when we're critical of someone, we have to demonize and make him or her some sort of awful totality. I remember the invasion of Iraq by the United States back in 2003. And we had to listen to our leader, George Bush, at that time, literally equating Saddam Hussein with Adolf Hitler and all the rest of it to justify this political need for black and white. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to get into the absurd debates about Chavez as to whether he's a disaster or the Jesus Christ incarnated or something like that. Here's what I would like to say. many leaders come and go in Latin America, making all kinds of promises that they're going to make a fundamental difference for the bottom two-thirds of the people in their societies, people who live at standards of living that are inhumane, suffering a lack of medical care, basic education, housing, and the minimal quality of life that those countries have the capacity to give them, but have systematically failed to do it. Chavez came into office and said he was going to do that too, making most observers think, oh good, another one of these leaders who promises but doesn't deliver. And what Chavez will always be remembered for is the fact that he delivered, that he wasn't like your average ruler. He actually came through and made fundamental changes in the conditions of life of the bottom two-thirds of the Venezuelan people, which no previous leader of that country had achieved over at least a century and a half. And the result of that is to make him an enormously important leader, notwithstanding this or that policy or this or that statement that he made. And I think that's his enduring legacy, and that's the challenge that he represents to every one of the other leaders in Latin America, and for that matter beyond, because he basically is saying to them, if you honor me, if you want to be taken seriously, put your real political emphasis where your verbalisms are. Make it happen for the people who need it most, who've suffered the longest, and whose transformation is the best hope your country can have for a sustained economic future. And I think he deserves everyone's honor because he did that in a significant way, far ahead of 99% of the other leaders that Latin America has suffered through for the last 100 years.
Oh, indeed. So he really did deliver on his promises. Very unusual. I've gone over the major promises that Obama has made, Rick, and not a single major promise he made was fulfilled. He literally spurned every single one of them. Some of the others he came through on, but the absolute ones most important, reflecting war and peace, and corporate empowerment, and police state the laws, and so on. I mean, he really governs America like a tyrant, and I've spelled it out in clear facts. And I've got an article I'm putting out tomorrow after John Brennan was nominated by the was approved by the Senate to be the next CIA head. Brennan is a serial killer, and Obama authorizes him, as I put it in my article, to kill. One more thing, and then we'll jump to the economy, Rick. Not only did Chavez help the Venezuelan people, but he turned Venezuela into a very prosperous country. In 2011, economic growth, if I remember the number I put in one of my articles, I think it was 4.6%. Last year, it was 5.6%. There are articles from the scoundrel media, as I like to call them, Rick, who say Venezuela's economy is a disaster. Well, 4.6%, that makes America's look like a disaster. And 5.6% makes it even look more extreme. And they're projecting 6% growth in 2013. Not bad. Not bad for a guy who's also taking care of ordinary people in the country.
Well, also, you might tell your listeners, too, that even as conservative, a fundamental newspaper as the New York Times yesterday chose to feature on its op-ed page a long article by the former head of Brazil.
Lula da Silva.
Lula da Silva, that's right. And let's make sure everybody understands. Brazil is the number one powerhouse economy of all Latin America. And there is its former leader, who left office as a very, very popular leader, saying that Chavez is one of the greatest things that ever happened to Latin America, showing him the kind of honor and respect that ought to make people think long and hard when they hear casual dismissals from people whose knowledge and concern about that part of the world is famous for its minuscule size, that the biggest leader of the biggest country, Brazil, in Latin America, takes his hat off in a very profound way on the pages of the New York Times yesterday to make it crystal clear that whatever might be said here in North America, those in South America have no ambiguity about what his role, Chavez's role, was and what it means.
Oh, absolutely. By the way, today is a state funeral, and at least 33 heads of state are attending the funeral, mostly from Latin America,
right.
Delegations of distinguished figures in at least 55 countries overall are attending it. I mean, it's a big, big event in Latin America,
right.
And as of yesterday, I believe it was, over 2 million people passed by his half-open coffin. He'll lie in state for a number of days. They may extend it because the lines just won't stop. People want to get a glimpse of him, and he deserves it. He did so much. Nobody's a saint, Rick, we know that.
Right.
Nobody's perfect. Chavez had his faults like everybody else.
That's right.
But compared with the average leader in the world, and as you say, 99% of them, there simply is no comparison between the model leader that he was and all the rest of them. And America never had anybody like him. They had a few that did some good things, but nothing that rose to the level of what Chavez did for his people.
I'll mention one thing just as a concrete thing. Because I have colleagues around the world who are economists like myself, I recently had occasion to talk with a colleague who straddles the fields of economics and public health and works in a major university up in Canada. And he was telling me that over the last 8 or 9 years, he at his public health department in Canada, together with several other public health departments, both in Canada and the United States, participated in what I'm quoting him now, he said, was the largest program of bringing public health to the mass of people that he had ever heard of or seen. And guess what? It was in the country of Venezuela. And it was organized and paid for by the Venezuelan government under Chavez through a cooperative arrangement with the government of Cuba. And together, the Venezuelans and the Cubans mobilized, I believe the number was 10,000 Cuban doctors to come to Venezuela over a multi-year period to train Venezuelans in all levels of mass public health, doctors, nurses, how to organize mass vaccinations of children, how to set up rural clinics and urban clinics. And what blew his mind as a North American professor of economics and public health was the scope, the ambition, and the commitment of the Venezuelan government to finally bring basic, decent, quality health care to the mass of the Venezuelan people who had never actually had it ever in the history of that country.
That's true.
And it made him, who wasn't all that political to begin with, a person, just think that something extraordinary was part of Venezuela under Chavez that he had never seen or knew of anywhere else.
And the way it was set up, cooperative trading, Rick, where Venezuela provided Cuba with oil and maybe some other products or whatever, and Cuba provided Venezuela with doctors,
right.
with nurses, with other medical providers. Now, talk about it's a sort of country to country a barter type trade.
Right.
But it's wonderful. A country rich in medical expertise provided it to a country that needed it in return for the oil that the first country needed. It's such a wonderful system. It works so well. Chavez established the system, and it's done cooperatively with a number of other countries who get into the system they call ALBA. A free trade system for the Americas, and it's been going on for a number of years. Well, it'll continue. None of this will change. He also gave Venezuelans free education. Anybody could get a college education, a PhD, a medical degree, free of charge in Venezuela. He wanted everybody to have housing. He wanted everybody to have affordable foods. He championed so much. And he made the economy grow and prosper at the same time. Just amazing. He didn't cheat business, Rick. You know, he wanted business to act responsibly. I remember back before the economic crisis broke at the end of 2007, I wrote about a banker saying they were having a party in Venezuela. They were making so much money. So the media scoundrels bashed Chavez, and the bankers were having a party.
Yeah. Anyway, let's talk some economics.
Let's talk some economics. I think reports of the great health of the American and world economy are greatly exaggerated. Would you agree?
Absolutely. It is extraordinary to me. We are now in the sixth year, count them, sixth year of this economic crisis. All accounts, including that of the United States government, agree that it happened. It began to really unravel on us in the second half of the year 2007. That means we're in year number six, and there is no end in sight. Let me stress that again. There is no end in sight. Periodically, over these almost six years that we are talking about a crisis, a lasting crisis, and let me stress that I'm part of the economics profession of the United States. We did not see it coming. We did not think it would happen. When it happened, we did not think it would last a long time. We were wrong. We did not think it would cut very deep. We were wrong. And now we what? Periodically, 2009 we did it, 2011 we did it. We think recovery is coming. It's a little bit reminds me of the famous remark of Herbert Hoover back in the early 1930s when he kept reassuring people in his press conferences that, quote unquote, prosperity was around the corner. Turned out it wasn't. Turned out that he was therefore no longer able to stay with the Republicans in power and gave way to Franklin Roosevelt and the Democrats. And likewise, we've had these periodic statements, we're quote-unquote recovering, which is another way of saying prosperity is around the corner. So let's look at where we are here in March 2013. Yes, there is a recovery, but only for a very small part of the United States. The stock market has recovered to where it was in 2007. That means we've had 6 years of nothing, 6 years of decline, and we're only back to where we were then, and people are finding this very remarkable, and it's more fun to focus on the fact that we're back to 2007 with the stock market, and not to focus on the what happened for 6 years that put us in such terrible shape for the stock market. And we're also back to where we were in 2007 in the rate of profits that many American corporations are getting. But let's remember, the beneficiaries of corporations that are making profits and the stock market that's back up to where it was in 2007 is a very small slice of the American people. Profitable corporations pay out big salaries to their top executives, true enough. And corporations making money can pay dividends to their shareholders, true enough. And that helps drive up the prices of stocks, true enough. So the stockholders in America and the top executives in America, they are doing wonderfully. But let's keep track of who they are. 1% of the American shareholders own 75% of the shares. So we're talking about good news for a very small number of people, and the same numbers apply to top executives. So they're having a recovery. They're doing very well. Now let's look at the rest of the U.S. economy. By far the most important number to keep in mind there is unemployment. Unemployment. Where was it before the crisis hit? Roughly 4.8% in 2007. How bad did it get during our crisis? 10% back in 2009. Okay. How far back are we? Have we recovered what we've lost? And the answer is not even close. Unemployment now is, depending on how you measure it, 7.7, 7.8, 7.9%. Okay, do the math. If we were at 4.8 before the crisis started, and we zoomed up to 10%, and now we're at, say, 7.8%, that means we're not even halfway back to the level of unemployment, which was too high to begin with, back in 2007. Don't tell, therefore, the millions of Americans who have no work that there's a recovery. Don't tell the millions of Americans who are lucky enough to have a job but have discovered over the last 4 or 5 years of crisis that the job now brings them fewer benefits, that the job now has much more insecurity about it. Don't tell the millions of Americans, indeed the first generation of young Americans, to experience the following. Don't tell them about a recovery. I'm talking about those who have to borrow unspeakable amounts of money to get a BA degree, let alone an advanced degree in a university, only to discover that the job market is so bad that having borrowed more than they could afford, they've gotten a degree that either won't get them any job or get them a job with an income that will make it impossible for them to ever pay back these enormous educational loans they've had to take out. We are hobbling our new generation of the young and the best educated people we could hope to have for the future of the American economy. Don't tell them there's a recovery. So, yeah, we have a peculiar economic system. It has a group of folks at the top, our big financial corporate leaders, our other corporate leaders, our major shareholders. They are the ones that everyone who follows this knows played a major role in bringing the crisis upon the rest of us. They are the ones who made sure that the government bailout went chiefly to them. And now they're making sure that the recovery is theirs to enjoy. The mass of people suffer the crisis they didn't cause. The mass of people missed out on the bailouts that went to the top. And now the mass of people are told the recovery hasn't quite gotten to you folks yet. You should keep waiting for some future when maybe it'll come. Meanwhile, those at the top who need it least are the ones who enjoy recovery the most. If there weren't the kind of shaped press that we live with, the reality of our economic situation would be the number one news story all day, every day.
Oh, indeed, Rick. And, of course, the unemployment numbers, as you know, have been so corrupted, the formula that they're calculated by has been so corrupted over the years. If unemployment was calculated the way it was 30 years ago, it wouldn't be 7% that it came in today.
Right.
It would be 23%.
Right. Well, even now, because there's so much debate over it, if you go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics in Washington, which is the major source for these numbers, they actually keep a whole bevy of unemployment statistics, not just the one that you get announced, the 7.7% that was announced today for the month of February, but they actually keep several of them. And the one that most economists now use, not that there isn't debate over it, too, there is, but the one that most of them use is what they call U-6. It's a number that the Bureau of Labor Statistics keeps record of that counts the following three people as your basic unemployed. Number one, those people looking for a full-time job and unable to find one. That's the 7.7%. But they add two other groups. The people who've been looking for a long time and have therefore dropped out of the labor market. They've just given up. They have turned to live at home, depending on their relatives, their spouse, their parents, their kids, or to become dependent on other relatives or friends or the charitable systems of the United States, churches and governments and so on. They add them, and finally they add a third group, all those people who want and need a full-time job but can't and have had to settle for a part-time job. If you put together, and I'm talking here only about the government numbers, if you put together the unemployed, those that have dropped out of the labor force, and the involuntarily part-time, then the current unemployment rate is 15 to 16%, which means, in real numbers, over 20 million Americans fall in the category, this U6, of people in a fundamentally untenable economic squeeze, no work, no income, or way less income than they basically need to have a minimum standard of living.
Indeed so. And you never hear anything about this. If it ever does get mentioned, Rick, it's given such short shrift that it goes right below the radar,
right,
and nobody knows about it. You could do a survey in New York or Chicago or any city. People go into the downtown area where a lot of people are and do a survey on the street, and I'll bet you wouldn't find 1 in 100 who could explain even a little bit of what you just did, Rick.
Yeah, well, you know, I try to take it one step further and appeal to people who are now open to this, what I'm about to say, more than I have seen in half a century. Think what it means that I just said 20-plus million people in our country who want to work a full-time job, who have been trying to get a full-time job. 20 million. They're sitting there becoming depressed about themselves and their lives because they have no job or no income or not enough income. They're becoming an increasing burden on their family and their friends and their community, and they don't want that, and the communities don't want that. They are therefore building up personal tensions, crises in their personal relationships, problems of alcoholism, mental disease, self-esteem collapses. I mean, the list of calamities is spectacular. Then turn to what the Federal Reserve tells us, which is that 1/5, 20% of our productive capacity, our machines, our tools, our factory, office, and store space is sitting empty, is sitting idle, is gathering rust and dust. What does that mean? It means we have 20 million people who want to work, and we have all the tools, equipment, and facilities and raw materials for them to work with and for them to work on. And if those 20 million people who want to work could be put together with the tools, equipment, and raw materials they need to work with, which are sitting there, we could have an output of wealth that could solve most of our social problems, poverty, help other nations. It could transform the lives of everyone. And we live in an economic system where I can say what I just said, and yet that system is a complete and total failure to put together the people who want to work with the tools, equipment, and raw material that's available to produce the output that could solve the social problems we can all see around ourselves. If ever there was an indictment of our economic system, that's it.
Rick, indeed so. And in a nation, the richest country in the world, it could be and it should be a model for all other world nations. And instead, it is a shame. It is an absolute shame. It's a disaster. It spurns millions of its own people, poverty at high levels, unemployment, homelessness, hunger, record food stamp numbers. And these numbers aren't going down. They're going up.
No, and people should understand that the real... One of the central causes of the crisis we're in was the fact that over the 30 years leading up to 2007, the real wages of American workers stopped rising as they had the previous 100 years. And the only way that the standard of living of the working people of America kept rising over the last 30 years was not because of wages, because those didn't go up, but because of debts. The American working class took on a level of debt for their homes through the mortgages, for their regular life through the credit card, for their automobile through the car loan, and nowadays for their students' education through the student loans. When 2007 came, it was a train wreck that had been building for 30 years. You cannot keep accumulating debts if the underlying wage you get, which is the only way to pay off those debts, isn't going up. And everyone knows that, and it doesn't take rocket science to figure it out. So we have an economy that's now crippled and hobbled because the American working class hasn't had a wage increase. Therefore, over the last 5 years, if you wanted to really deal with the underlying causes of the crisis, you would have finally had to do something about raising the wages, the real wages of the American working class. And what have we actually had? A decline. A further decline of the real wages.
Oh, we did too.
And the joke is, you know, this, and I say joke with sarcasm, the joke in economics is
that when those at the top continue to squeeze those at the bottom, the vast majority of the working class, in the end, what the rich people don't understand, and they will come to their grief too, is that they too, in the end, depend on the mass.
Rick, we're out of time. I wish we could go on. You are so, so right. And I have quoted from what you just said.
Okay.
I look forward to getting you back again, Rick.
All right, Steve, and good luck to you and your important program.
Thank you. Join us over the weekend. We're on at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.